Paul's second letter to the church in Corinth. And last week we were looking at the closing verses of chapter 4. That chapter gives us an almost frightening picture of what Paul went through as a Christian serving the Lord Jesus. In that chapter, Paul tells us that he was afflicted in every way. Suffering seemed to be piled on him from every direction. Paul tells us he was perplexed, he was baffled, he was bewildered by the demands and problems that he had to cope with. He tells us he was crushed, he was left feeling as if a steamroller had run over him again and again and again. He was struck down, he was hit by blows that knocked him right off his feet and left him feeling as if he would never get up again. He says he carried Jesus' death around with him wherever he went. It was as if he had to be crucified again and again and again. He says he was handed over by God to death constantly. It was as if he was being systematically destroyed and yet was still expected to keep going. Those are just some of the ways in which Paul describes what he had to suffer in the course of his life serving the Lord Jesus. And yet, Paul says in chapter 4, verse 16, he said it at the beginning of the chapter in verse 1, but now he says it again at the end of the chapter, verse 16, he says, "We do not lose heart." He says, "We don't despair. We don't give up." Why not? Well, he's given lots of reasons here in chapter 4. But in verses 16 and 17 of chapter 4, he gives the biggest, the most awesome reason of all. He says, "For this light, momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. For we look not to the things that are seen, but the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient. They're just passing by. But the things that are unseen are eternal." However big Paul's sufferings here in this world might seem, compared with the glory that's coming, they're trivial. All Paul's troubles here in this world, the illnesses, the loneliness, the persecution, the disappointments, the weariness, the times when he's stabbed in the back by people he trusted, all these things are preparing for him an eternal weight of glory. And it's beyond all comparison. When you look at his troubles just on their own, they seem heavy. But when you balance them against the hugeness of the glory that's coming, those troubles don't count for anything. Yes, they seem to be long, stretched out day after day, year after year, those troubles continue, but they're the preparation for an eternity of sharing God's glory and God's joy. This life is short. It ends so quickly, but God's life never ends. And God's people are going to share God's life forever. We all make choices, don't we? again and again, we have to decide whether it's worth going through something unpleasant, for the benefits that it'll bring. You've got teeth that are out of alignment. Should you wear a brace? You're putting on weight. Should you go on a diet? You've got the opportunity to go on some course and get some qualification, but it'll mean an awful lot of hard work and late nights. Well, one of the things we take into account when we're making those decisions is, how long will I have to put up with the inconvenience or the pain? How long will the benefits last? I'll be wearing that brace for 12 months. But then I'll have a nice smile for 60 years. It'll take 6 months of rigorous dieting to get my weight down. But then if I look after myself, I should be in shape for the next 40 years. All right, I'll have to work night and day for the next 3 months to pass that exam. But then I'll have a better job for the next 10 years. Well, Paul's doing that sort of arithmetic. 10 years, 20 years, 30 years of trouble and hurt and exhaustion here in this world. Sounds a long time. But what is that compared with the glory of the world to come? A glory that will go on and on and on, becoming richer and fuller and more wonderful forever. A cup of joy that will never be drunk to the bottom. A story where, as C.S. Lewis puts it, every chapter is better than the one before, and you never reach the end of the book. That's why Paul doesn't lose heart, because he's got his mind set on the glory that's to come for those who belong to Jesus Christ. Now, I have to say that Paul's way of viewing things is not fashionable today, even among Christians who take the Bible seriously. I meet very few Christians whose minds are full of the glory of the world to come. When I go to conferences, I hear very few speakers talking about the eternal delights that God's people are going to experience in that world. You know, there are countless books being written to help Christians who have problems. But nearly all those books are about how you can solve those problems now, or at least how you can make those problems more bearable. There are very few books that gives Paul's answer. There are very few books that say, look, fill your mind with the thought of eternity, and your problems here and now will seem less important. So, Jane is in an unhappy marriage. She married when she was very young. Her husband's turned out to be very different from what she expected. Well, there are dozens of Christian books out there counseling Jane about the strategy she should use to improve her marriage, and about whether it would be right to end her marriage, and about what support she needs to survive her marriage. And at least some of those books give some helpful, sensible advice. But they all have the same message. Jane, it's important that you should have a happier life here in this world, and here are some tips to achieve it. That's what the authors see as the great need. Somebody else says, I'm single and I'm desperate to be married. Somebody else says, my children are so rebellious and they're breaking my heart. And somebody else says, I'm struggling with same-sex attraction. And somebody else says, I'm dyslexic and it's such a hindrance. Somebody else says, I can never find a church where I fit in. And the books roll off the presses, helping Christians to solve all these problems. And I'll say again, it's not wrong to look for ways of dealing with all those troubles. Paul does give lots of practical lessons in his letters. But in the end, Paul's advice is here. If Paul were writing to Jane or to Mike or to Gary or to Maggie, he'd be saying, it may be that this pain you're going through will never go away here in this life. It may be that no strategy you adopt will change your situation. It may be that this is the way that Christ's suffering overflows into your life. It may be that this is the burden that God has ordained that you'll carry till the very end of your life. But this life is short. And this light, momentary affliction is preparing for you an eternal weight of glory. So Jane, set your mind on the glory. Mike, you're going to share the throne of Christ forever. Gary, you're going to swim in the river of God's pleasures for all eternity. Maggie, you're going to sing with sheer joy, and your song will never end. So all of you, keep reminding yourselves of what lies ahead, and you will not lose heart. That's what kept Paul going. His problems didn't go away. The persecutions never became less intense. The temptations never became less severe. The loneliness never stopped. Do you remember those heartbreaking last words that Paul wrote from his prison cell in Rome? Timothy, please do your best to come quickly. Please come before winter. I am so lonely. Timothy, bring the cloak that I left behind me at Troas, because I'm cold here in this cell. When I was brought into court for my first hearing, no one came to stand with me. I've been abandoned by everybody. Bring my books, bring my parchments. Time drags so heavily here in prison. Things never became easier for Paul. But listen to his cry of joy when he wrote that letter. The Lord will rescue me from every evil here in this world. No, he will bring me safely into his heavenly kingdom. To him be glory forever and ever. Amen. Paul's mind was set on the glory. Shivering with cold, lonely, abandoned by his friends, bored. His mind was full of the glory. The Lord's going to bring me into his heavenly kingdom. We need so much to regain the priorities that Paul lived by. When we're under pressure here in this world, so often all we think about are the problems and whether there's any way we can solve them. And we tend to feel that thinking about heaven is something to do when you've got nothing else to do. When you've got no problems pressing on you. For Paul, thinking about the world to come is the only way of surviving when the pressures are greatest. We do not lose heart, he says. Why? Because this light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory. We look not at the things that are seen, but the things that are unseen. We don't look at the transient things of this world. We look at the eternal things, the things of the world to come. 4. This is chapter 5, verse 1. We're moving on. 4. We know that if the tent, which is our earthly home, is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. Paul talks about our existence here in this world as living in a tent. The tent, which is our earthly home. And he talks about our existence in the world to come as living in a building, a solid, lasting construction, a building from God, eternal in the heavens. And that's a very graphic contrast, isn't it? The contrast between a tent and a building. I remember talking to friends from Kosovo who had to flee during the civil war there. And the only place they had to live in was a tent. And they lived in it through a bitter winter, spent in a muddy field. It was cold. It was uncomfortable. The tent was thin and could easily be blown away. It wasn't going to last. Well, Paul says, all the time we're living here in this world, we're living in a tent. My friends from Kosovo dreamed of the day when they would live in a solid house. Paul says, in the world to come, that's what we'll have. But here in this world, we live in a tent. Now, often when Christians read these verses, they assume that Paul is talking just about our physical body and saying that this body is like a tent. It's temporary, it's inadequate, it's fragile. While the body we shall have in the world to come is indestructible. It's full of strength, it's everlasting. Well, I'm sure Paul is thinking about our bodies. But I don't think that he is thinking just about our bodies. He's thinking about the whole structure of our life here. He's thinking about the frameworks within which we live our lives. All the things that we depend on for security and comfort here in this world. I'm not just a naked, isolated soul, am I? There are frameworks within which I operate. I have a body with which I relate to the world around me. I have a family which surrounds me. I have a network of friends. I have a job. I have a bank account. I live in a town where there are shops and railway stations and doctors and chemists. I have access to the internet. These are the structures within which I live my life. They're my tent. Without those structures, I'd feel vulnerable, lonely, isolated, helpless. I depend on those structures. But, and this is Paul's point, they're not solid. They can't last. And really, they don't do their job very well. Yet, I have a body. But it's a body that doesn't work very well. It causes me a lot of pain. It goes wrong terribly easily. I have a family. But families cause a lot of stress. And yes, real pain a lot of the time. I have my network of friends, but some of them let me down. And some of them move away. And some of them I just lose touch with or I grow apart from. I have a job and I'm very glad I've got a job. But it brings a lot of pressure. And there are no guarantees about how long it'll last. And I can live in this town and I can imagine that all my needs will be met in this town. But lots of people live in towns and are desperately lonely. And they find that living in town exposes you to vandalism and to muggings and to crime. Do you see all the structures that are our tent? All the things that we look to for comfort and security, they're all unsatisfactory. They all fail us. They all break down. And none of them lasts. Living here in this world means living in a tent. A tent that lets in rain. And that gets torn. And through which the winds blow. And that collapses in the end. Some tents are destroyed by storms when they're almost new. Children die. Others get older and more weathered. And then finally they're shredded in a storm. But in the end, all our tents are temporary. That's what Paul's been talking about all through chapter 4. What a wretched tent he lives in. He's got a body, but it's a body that's aching and it's exhausted. And it's been ripped to shreds by repeated floggings. And it's been stoned again and again, and it'll never function properly now. He's got his network of friends, but they never seem to be there when he needs them. He's a Roman citizen, and that ought to give him some protection. But it doesn't, because it's not going to help him if an angry crowd starts trying to lynch him. He's got work to do, but it brings him heartbreak again and again. Paul's tent is a tent full of rips and tears, where you find snakes in the bedding and insects crawling all over the canvas. And there are times when the storms blow the tent down and he's got to struggle to put it up again in the howling gale. And he knows that one day his tent is going to be destroyed. He's going to die. His body won't be able to take the strain any longer. And all the structures that have been the framework of his life, none of them are going to be able to shelter him or comfort him then. I remember when I first really felt the truth of Paul's words here. I was sitting by the bedside of a dying believer. An old lady, a very dear friend. Her tent had lasted a long time. She was into her 80s, but the tent had worn very thin. She'd been an active, energetic person, always busy, always working. But now she was lying there, motionless, hardly breathing. Her eyes shut. She'd been happily married, but her husband had died some years earlier. She was a widow. She'd had brothers and sisters, but they were all dead. She'd had nephews and nieces whom she loved, but none of them were there for her now. She had her home, which she kept perfectly. And a garden that was beautiful because she kept it so well. She had a few treasured possessions. But she'd left all of those things behind because she was in hospital now. She didn't even have her own clothes. Just a hospital nightgown. She'd had her network of friends. But they'd grown older, she'd grown old. And some were in the grave and some were in nursing homes, and some had lost their memories and wouldn't remember her name. She was just lying there. And she'd lost all the things that gave her life structure and security. Her tent was barely standing. And I thought, well, at least I can be here with her. I can hold her hand. So that when finally she slips from this world, she won't be on her own. And so I sat with her till midnight. Until the nurse came to me and said, look, she'll still be here in the morning. You go home, get some sleep. So I kissed Lil goodbye. And I went and I returned in the morning to find that she had died an hour after I'd said goodbye to her. And I understood what the Bible means when it says that we come into this world naked and we leave this world naked. Everything had been stripped from her. Her husband, her family, her friends, her home, her garden, and her pastor. I wasn't allowed to be there with her at the end. And finally, her body, the last layer of the tent, was blown away. And she slips into the darkness of death, a naked soul. Her tent was destroyed. Listen again to Paul's words here in chapter 5, verse 1. We know that if the tent, which is our earthly home, is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. There's no if about it, really, is there? When Paul says, if the tent which is our earthly home is destroyed, it's if in the sense of when, it's if in the sense of although. Though our tent, which is our earthly home, is destroyed, and it will be, we have a building from God. A house constructed not by human ingenuity. A house not made with hands. A house that's eternal. We have a building that will stand forever, says Paul, in the heavenly world. The tents that we live in here in this world are largely tents that we've built for ourselves or that others have built for us by human ingenuity, by human enterprise. Yes, our bodies are given to us, but we train them and we exercise them. And we develop skills and we get qualifications. And then we build the various layers of canvas which we think will give us security and comfort. The careers, the networks, the families, the homes, the collection of banner books. And none of them last. All those structures are built with human hands. And many of them wear away even while we're here in this world. And all of them vanish when death overtakes us. But Paul says, for the believer, we have a house not made with hands. We have a house that God has made for us. We are going to live in a new world. A heavenly world. And our life there in that world isn't going to be living in a tent that we've built for ourselves. A temporary, fragile, inadequate structure. It's going to be living, says Paul, in a house. A temple. A palace that God has built for us. The word that's translated building is a word that would usually be used for a great building. Yes, a temple or a palace. Here in this world, we are never secure. There in that world, we are totally, eternally secure. All the pleasures, all the comforts, all the structures that we build for ourselves here, they're temporary. And they can be lost so easily. But the joys of that world, the comforts of that world, the securities of that world, can never be taken from us. Start with the body. If you like, it's the inner tent. These bodies, so fragile, aging so quickly, so prone to illness, so easily tired, and finally, giving up, dying, dissolving into dust. That's our bodies here. But the bodies of God's people in the world to come, indestructible, beautiful, radiant with power and strength, glorious. in the strict sense, glorious, shining with God's glory, God's majesty. When Jesus comes, says Paul in Philippians, he will transform our bodies of shame to be like his own glorious body. We're going to run. We're going to run swift as the wind through the fields of the New Eden. We're going to sing with voices that will be more beautiful than the voices of angels. Our eyes are going to gaze on beauty beyond imagination, and our eyes will never grow tired or dim or need corrective glasses. Our hands are going to shape the new creation to bring out all its infinite potential, and our hands will never grow weary in serving him. These bodies, they're just scruffy bits of canvas or leather. They're wearing out. But the bodies of God's people in that world will be real bodies, true human bodies that reflect the image of God perfectly and never growing old. Think about the network of friends within which we live. It's very precious to us. But how temporary it is. People I was so close to when I was at college. We had our own little tight-knit circle of a dozen or so friends. And we thought we'd be friends all our lives. And there's maybe one or two of them now that I hear from. Even within this church, I can go back and read the names of the folk who were members here 25 years ago. Hardly any of them are still here now. Some have died. Some fell out with us, or we fell out with them. And some moved away, and some abandoned the faith. How fragile that layer of the tent has proved to be. But now think about the world to come. Think about the friendships that will be the framework of our life there. Perfect friendships in which we'll love one another with a completely unselfish, ungreedy, utterly trustworthy love. I'm going to be linked up with countless people who love me and who understand me perfectly, and whom I can trust for everything. And there'll be no misunderstandings. And there'll be no letting one another down. And they're always going to be there for me. And I'm always going to be there for them. And our love for one another is never going to grow cold. And none of them are going to grow old and senile so that they don't remember my name any longer. And none of them is going to die. So the friendship we have is going to become richer and richer and richer as we share together in Jesus Christ and the joys of his world. The network of my friends here in this world is just a flimsy fly sheet. But there it'll be a rock solid diamond canopy that's going to last forever. Everything about that world, everything about that life is eternal. The possessions I have there are eternal possessions. The employment I have there will be eternal employment. No redundancy there. No unemployment. Just the never-ending task of bringing glory to a God in a way that I can do and which nobody else could do in exactly the same way. I'll have work for which God has prepared me, which is absolutely unique to myself and which is utterly satisfying. You know, no employer here in this world can guarantee his employees lifelong work, can he? None of them can promise his employees total satisfaction. Your job, your career, it's just another layer of this tent. And it's man-made. But we're not going to be living in a tent there in that world. We're going to live in a house. We're going to live in a palace. And it's one that God, knowing my needs, knowing my personality perfectly, has designed for me. Remember, it's not made with human hands. It's built by God himself. And it's going to be perfectly right for me. It's worth thinking about the tent in which you're living today. What are the structures? What are the frameworks that you live in from day to day? How secure are they? So often, like the rich fool with his bumper harvest, we assume that they can last. But the tents of this world never last. How much satisfaction do they bring you? Can they really satisfy your longing for security? How long are they going to last? You know, some of us live in more comfortable tents than others. But none of them can really satisfy. And none of them are secure. All the things that we pour so much energy into building up, because that makes us feel secure, none of them can actually last. Paul's tent was thoroughly uncomfortable. In fact, in many ways, it was a horrible tent to live in. Remember? Afflicted in every way, perplexed, persecuted, struck down, handed over to death constantly. He says here in chapter 2, verse 2, in this tent we groan. That was Paul's life here in this world, groaning. He found himself saying again and again, this is awful. This is horrible. Please let it stop. I don't want to live in this tent anymore. And what was Paul's comfort when he did feel like that? It was the fact that he could say, I'm not going to live in this tent forever. This is just a tent. It's for a little while. It's temporary. And he says there's a house. There's a temple, there's a palace that's being prepared for me. In this tent we groan, longing to put on our heavenly dwelling. It's an interesting phrase, isn't it? To put on our heavenly dwelling. He's moving from the picture of a tent as something we live in, and moving to the picture of clothes that we put on. And we'll talk more about that, God willing, next week. But the important phrase to note now is just that phrase, we're longing to put on our heavenly dwelling. Paul's groaning because life here in this world is so horrible for him. His tent is so leaky. But he's longing. He's longing for another world. He's longing for the world where he'll see the Lord Jesus Christ. He's longing for the world where he'll at last be at home. No longer just living a transitory life, but living the life of eternity. Paul says we're longing for that. Groaning and longing. That's the life of the Christian. Perhaps it's more the life of the Christian as we get older, and as the tents we live in become more and more tatty, and as the satisfactions of this world become less and less satisfying, and as God turns the screws, and as the gardener, the vine dresser, cuts away and prunes the things that we once loved. But in some measure, this is the life of every Christian. We groan. We groan here in this tent. We say there's so much here in this world that makes me feel unhappy. And then we look forward. We look forward with eager longing and with certain hope. And that hope fills us with joy. However painful life in the tent is, we can look forward with eager, joyful anticipation for the house into which one day we're going to step. It's already being built for us, and we're being prepared for it. And one day the key will be put into your hand, and you'll step across the threshold, and you'll enter into the eternity of joy that Christ bought for you if you belong to him.